Welcome to the Fourth Dimension with Toby C., where participants dare to disclose bizarre experiences that occur in early recovery. The battle between good and evil, of God and of the occult. The psychic challenges we all encounter when trying to do the right thing. Now, here's Toby.
Hey, it's me. It's Toby. I'm back. Yeah. Welcome back if you've been here before to the Fourth Dimension with Toby C. If it's your first time, welcome. Welcome to the Fourth Dimension. This is a concept show. And the concept is you're not going to hear us talking about a lot of God. God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. It's very much a recovery show. We're going to talk about the Garden of Eden, but we're not going to be talking about Adam and Eve. We're not going to be talking about the forbidden fruit. Yep, we're going to be talking about the snake today. That's what we're going to do. We're going to keep it interesting. And I got a good friend in the studio today, Christopher M. Christopher, welcome.
Thanks, Toby.
I've known Christopher for a long time, and we're going to take a little magical mystery tour like we do every show. We're going to go back in time to Christopher's earliest memories of recovery. And what we're going to do is we're going to try to take a calm and open-minded journey back in time and try to imagine if there was something external that was really interfering with our most desperate moments to get better. That's the theme of the show, by the way. Evil resistance that many of us experience in early recovery. And that's what we're going to be doing today. And you'd be surprised, you know, at the time when we're suffering, we're trying to get better, and maybe you can relate to this, Christopher, that we are so distracted in so much agony, and we really didn't know who to put the finger of blame on, that we were too busy blaming him or her or it, or blaming ourselves or blaming God. But I'm telling you, if you really open up your mind, and that's what we're going to try to do today, there was possibly another actor in the scene. And it could have been evil, and it could have been external. And again, we're not here really to talk about the devil today. We're here to just try to glean some experience about the existence of evil so that God, a God of our understanding, becomes more relevant and less abstract. And that's the key to this deal. Both Christopher and I are members of the 12-step program, and one of our mantras is that there is only one who has all power, and that one is God, and may you find him now. That no human power could relieve our suffering, but only God could and would if he were sought. And I'm telling you, my friend, my experience and countless other people's experiences, that the moment we desperately try to seek a God of our understanding, something external interfered with our most desperate attempts to get better. So that's my monologue, and I'm sticking to it. I had to give you the who, what, when, how, and why. We're coming to you live recorded from lovely Palm Springs, California, the hotbed of recovery. And the reason why I'm doing this is I'm just trying to do some 12-step work. And maybe this hour or two, the newcomer or somebody who's stuck in recovery just might hear something different that might make the difference about getting closer to a God of your understanding and acquiring something called God consciousness. Yeah. So Christopher, take a deep breath and take us back. You know, this is a long segment before we take a break here, and give us a little history about your experience down on the very bottom and your earliest memories of trying to get better, where you were doing something, whether it was alcohol or drugs or something, but you were doing it to some degree that some aspect of your life was unmanageable. What do you think?
Well, that's, excuse me, that's easy. I know, even before I started to get involved in drugs and alcohol, I had a lot of behaviors that were extremely dark, in the sense that I just, and I would always be extremely ashamed of them, because I was raised in a good family. I had parents that didn't drink, that didn't use drugs, that treated me well. But I was just constantly disappointing my parents with things like stealing, lying. Just the whole, it was almost like a syndrome, in the sense that, like, if I saw a sign that said wet paint, I had to touch it. So like if you, I have a very defiant streak in me. So if you tell me not to do something, you can bet I'm going to do it. Mm-hmm. And
by the way, you grew up with a fairly healthy religious upbringing, yeah, and your parents worship, and you got the God indoctrination and all that.
Absolutely.
How'd you feel about that? Did you resist that too?
Methodist church. I don't know. Once I turned about 12 or 13, I mean, well, I was taking alcohol to the church activities, you know, I mean, it just, but I did, I grew up in the church. I went to church every Sunday with my family and, didn't really buy into it. I was there. I learned a lot.
So maybe you were acting out at an early age, just as kind of maybe a subconscious protest to this this dogma that you were being force fed. What do you think?
I think it had a lot, maybe a lot to do with just like I was expected to do and behave a certain way, and I didn't ever seem to be able to live up with it and live up to it, and. Maybe along the line somewhere, I decided that the negative attention was good enough, you know.
Interesting. So you're opening yourself up to negativity, and you were getting some good attention from that, weren't you?
I guess so. I mean, it's hard. You look back and you wonder, well, why did I do that? And you still look back at things you did when you're a kid, you know, before you even knew what you were doing. You're like, why would I do that?
Sure.
You know,
the reason why was because it made us feel good.
Yeah, there's even a little buzz. Days. There is the shoplifting, the stealing.
The risky behavior was exciting. You know, there it was.
I never had a need for it. I liked the way it made me feel, though, for sure.
All right, so you opened yourself up to that negative vibration at an early age. Okay, like many of us do. It's part of the rite of passage.
Absolutely. And it didn't seem to, you couldn't deter me. You couldn't punish me out of it. That was something that I realized right away. It was like my parents would punish me and it just made me more determined to live the way that I wanted to. Mm-hmm. And you know, when drugs and alcohol became involved, it was just kind of like throwing gas on the fire, I guess. Mm.
So how did you finally crash? What was the cause of your initial crash where you hit bottom, whatever your bottom was, however you want to describe it, where you knew you needed to get some help and stop what you were doing. That would have been your first bottom. Describe that.
I didn't get sober until I was 32. And I was very suspicious that I had a problem. I had been exposed to the big book in prison. And for, you know, several years before I got put in prison, my parents chased me around and tried to get me into these programs, and I just wanted nothing to do with it. I pretty much just dedicated my life to pursuing what I loved, which was to get loaded. But it got really bad quick for me. So, you know, by the time I was 22, I was on the way to prison for the first time. I had caused a fatal accident when I was 19. Immediately following a stint in the rehab.
Now let's back up. Cause I think you're skipping ahead here.
Yeah.
Sounds to me.
It's a long story.
Well, that's okay. We don't. And again, by the way, I gotta do a quick repeat in the middle of this long segment. My name is Toby C and the name of the show is called The Fourth Dimension. We're here with Christopher M and we're talking about the subject of evil resistance that many of us experience in early recovery, whatever early recovery, you know, whatever you define as early recovery. Early recovery for many of us is when we've hit bottom or we're going to prison or we just had a real tragic experience. Now, I want to back up for a minute with Christopher here because you mentioned that you had an accident and there was a fatality involved, and it's when you were quite young and you had just gotten out of rehab.
Immediately following
my
big bust with my family.
Right. And so you got into rehab. Ended up going to rehab on your own volition, or was this something that was suggested by the family, or they just wanted to save you? Was it an intervention?
It was.
How'd you get into rehab? The very beginning.
So I'd gone off to school in Kansas City. I'm from Houston originally. So I'd been drinking and carrying on and getting in trouble, but I made it into college. And when I went away to college, I chose, this is probably some of my dark thinking, was to get the hell away from my family because they were very loving, caring parents. And I wasn't able to just snow them and just disappear for days on end. And so I chose the school that was the farthest away because I didn't want to be governed.
There you go. Yeah.
And that was the bottom line. Like, you know, I guess a lot of kids, when they go to school and stuff, they make decisions based on like careers or what they want to study. But mine was like, how do I get away from my parents and do what I want?
How did you end up in your first rehab? Was it a nudge from the judge? Was it court ordered? Was it?
No, the first one wasn't. My parents caught me with a load of dope. Mm-hmm. And I was smuggling dope from Houston to Kansas City. And I'd been doing that up there while I was there through the mail. And then when I came home, I sort of created a vacuum. And so I started sending it to my buddy. And my parents caught me with a big load of marijuana that was mailing to my friend. And his father happened to be my brother's fraternity brother. And he recognized the name. And he was just like, something's funny going on. And they opened up the box. And
there it was.
Yeah.
Okay. So your parents were absolutely devastated. And they said, Christopher, you need help.
Yeah.
And what did you say? Yeah. Okay. You just kind of wanted to avoid the shame. Do I sit there and deal with this shame and this guilt and this nagging, or do I just acquiesce and go to rehab? Was that what it was all about?
I wasn't self-sufficient at the time.
So you needed them.
I think I was standing on the precipice of, okay, you can say, you know, screw you guys and run off and depend on dealing drugs. But I wasn't that far into it. I didn't think that I could get away with it, or I wasn't ready to just throw my life to the wind at that point. Mm-hmm. And so they were like, you've got to get help. And if you don't get help, we're not going to pay for anything.
I love it. So what you're really describing here, Christopher, is yeah, even at that moment, there was no dependence on a God of your understanding or dependence on a higher power. Your dependence on your parents. And if they said go to rehab because you didn't want to experience shame or risk getting thrown out on the street and fending for yourself, that's what it was. They were your higher power. Boy, there it is. There's some evil resistance in the earliest moments of recovery. You know you needed help. You're getting a bad message from somebody who... there was some toxic, passive-aggressive thing going on, as there often is in the dysfunctional family system. There it is. So, you know, when we come back after this break, I want to continue going back to that earliest moment in recovery or rehab, and some of the bad directions or the bad advice that you accepted. And some of the tragedies that befell you and other people, maybe as a result of this bad advice, maybe not. But nonetheless, it was a very traumatic, discouraging experience. And I want you to go ahead and rest up and really lay it on, because the next segment's only 6 minutes before the bottom of the hour, Christopher. So lay it on, baby. Again, my name is Toby C, and this show is called The Fourth Dimension. We talk about evil resistance that many of us experience in our earliest attempts to get better and recover from suffering and misery. We're going to be right back with Christopher M. here on The Fourth Dimension.
Enjoy our message, then please visit us at itmtoby.com.
The imagination to take us places we might be afraid to go. You are entering the fourth dimension with Toby C. There is no such thing as coincidences. Here's Toby.
Okay, we're back with Christopher M. here on the fourth dimension with Toby C. concept show. And this is a recovery show, and I'm telling you, you may hear us talk about drug and alcohol abuse, but I'm telling you, if you listen carefully, this show can pertain to anybody who's suffering and in real misery and is trying to get better, because what we're talking about here is not so much God, we're talking about the antithesis of God. We're talking about the devil, okay? And by the way, We're just trying to have a very healthy understanding about the presence of evil, okay? Because trust me, there's two extreme behaviors. One extreme behavior is to disbelieve in the existence of evil, okay? That's called denial. And the other extreme behavior is to have an excessive, unhealthy interest in Satan. And that ain't this show either. We just want to be open-minded and take a journey back to what was really going on. And Christopher is about to share with us what was really going on in his first experience in rehabilitation, in recovery. He was young. And take us back on that experience and what happened there, Christopher.
I think... So the way I remember those days were, you know, tremendous shame, still wanting to, I didn't really want to separate from my family. I couldn't walk away from them. And, you know, they offered me treatment and I decided that that was the best option at that time. And I wasn't really sold on it. I didn't really want to get sober. I just didn't want to disappoint my family. And I went to treatment and they, you know, they diagnosed me as an alcoholic and polysubstance abuse. I was basically just a drunk and I would do anything that came in front of me. So they put I did that for like, I don't know, I think it was a 30-day program. And during that time I saw this doctor one time, he was the attending physician. And, on exit, he talked with my parents and said, you know, your son has a really bad attention deficit problem and we're going to test him and find out if that's true. And so they tested me and sure enough, I was off the charts, ADD. And I just remember kind of thinking like, you know, well, that explains my bad grades, you know, and because I was always, I had a good IQ. I tested well on things that I was interested in, but.
Did anybody plant that idea in your head that maybe this ADHD was a result of your bad grades, or did you just come up with that? Because where I'm leading to this is maybe somebody, if not you, concluded that maybe you didn't have a drinking problem. And maybe your ADHD, what do you think?
Well, yeah, I think it was like a great thing to use as a diversion from the real problem, I think. You know, like the real problem, I think, in reality, looking back, was that I had a major drug and alcohol problem. But when he diagnosed me with this disorder, he gave me a prescription for Ritalin. So I literally walked out of a rehabilitation center with a prescription for Ritalin, which was, I found out almost immediately, was just like a low-grade speed. And when I took it, you know, I'm not really aware of like this recovery stuff in the big book.
It felt pretty good though.
Oh yeah. I took it and I immediately thought, that's great. I took another one, you know, so I doubled down.
Did you stop drinking?
I wasn't drinking.
There you go. So you
but
did.
I had my thing. You okay, see
but,
what I'm saying?
But I get it. But you successfully stopped drinking. That was the point, wasn't it? You went to rehab. Why? To stop drinking. You got out of rehab, Christopher, and what'd you do? You stopped drinking, didn't you? Good on you. But you're a junkie all of a sudden on Ritalin.
Yeah, and so now I'm getting kind of crazy with that stuff. I'm going back to junior college to fix my grades from the previous year. And I can't remember the exact time frame, but initially, so what ended up happening was I figured out that if you crush them up and snort them, that it's even better and it works faster. And so I started doing that and I had a lot to do at school that day. I was taking a full load and I got up in the morning and I crushed up a couple pills and I snorted them and I got in my car and I headed off to the junior college. And then this is about a 12-mile drive or something. And when I got to the town preceding the college, I was going through an intersection, four lanes, one turn lane in the middle. I was doing about 60 miles an hour. I think the speed limit was 45. And there was a car facing me with a blinker on in the turn lane. And I was in the middle lane. And I proceeded through what I perceived to be a green light. And when I got to maybe 100 feet from the intersection, the car literally just turned right in front of me. And the last thing I really remember was just hitting the brakes, not understanding what was going on. I remember the seatbelt snapping across my chest. And I remember the passenger in the front seat looking at me through the window and then my hood crumpling up and then my body flying forward, my legs and my arms flying forward and the seatbelt snapping me back and throwing me against the the seat knocking me out. So the impact speed was about 47, I think. And the next thing I remember was a police officer shaking me.
Okay, you gotta. Sorry, we're gonna keep you on the edge of your seat, listeners, but we're gonna be back with Christopher M. talking about evil resistance, evil experiences that happen in early recovery, like so many of us experience. I'm Toby C. The name of the show is called The Fourth Dimension with Toby C. We're gonna be right back after this break.
Message, then please visit us at itmtoby.com.
Making sense out of nonsense, making you as curious and uncomfortable as possible with the truth. You've landed in the fourth dimension with Toby C.
Okay, we're going to be continuing here with Christopher M. Man, we cut you off right at the most critical moment. Hey, if you're just joining us, you know, we talk about evil resistance that many of us experience in early recovery. My name is Toby C. I'm the host. The name of the show is The Fourth Dimension. That's Christopher M. chewing the ice in the background there. This is live recorded. We go with it all, man. You get everything. I had a buddy the other day, he started his Honda 600 motorcycle outside the door here, you know. And I had the do not disturb recording sign on, so. Take us, so what happened, Christopher? There it is, man. You're having this experience, this out-of-body, surreal experience, this horrific accident at this intersection. Take a deep breath, man. Continue.
So the police officer was shaking me and he was yelling, "You've killed someone." And I don't remember that very clearly. And the next thing I remember was waking up in a hospital bed and there were two officers pulling my blood. And I don't know if you've seen that movie Flight with, I think it's Denzel Washington.
I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it.
Yeah, so he wakes up in the scene is them pulling his blood and you're hearing his inner dialogue. And I remember it. It was the exact same as this movie. When I watched the movie, I was like, oh my God, that's exactly what it was like.
What was the inner dialogue?
The inner dialogue was, oh my God, do they know?
Wow.
So immediately self.
You're thinking about yourself.
Am I caught?
Right.
Along with a million other thoughts like, oh my God, I've killed someone. I've taken someone's life. You're horrible. You're a murderer. This type of, you know.
By the way, did they say somebody died?
Yeah.
Or did they say you killed someone?
You killed someone.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, how nice.
Mm. Yeah. Wow. And so what ended up happening was that drug was not tested for as a intoxicant. And so I came back clean.
So they were testing for opioids or maybe
for drugs.
For drugs and alcohol.
Right. Alcohol.
And there wasn't any alcohol.
And I came back clean and I decided right there and then I would never tell a soul about what had actually happened. And I kept that to myself and it just destroyed me for years. And I started having PTSD, re-seeing the accident over and over on a daily basis. And I went back to using and,
It's like a scene out of the Twilight Zone.
Yeah, and I said this earlier was I didn't really want to throw my family away, but I'm telling you, I was so miserable. Then the drugs became so important to me that I was willing to walk away from my entire life at that point. So I totally dedicated my life to dealing drugs and just creating havoc.
So what you're describing, Christopher, possibly is that at that moment, you experienced unimaginable, immeasurable shame.
Yeah.
And nobody was going to know that. It was your secret, but there it lingered. And let me ask you this, you know, and maybe, you know, maybe your demon that you carried around that robbed you of a decade of your life before you really got your shit together. You know, there was your demon. There's your ghost story. That shame that you had to wake up to every morning, man. Let me ask you this. Did that shame give you an overwhelming and compelling reason to keep you loaded every freaking day?
Yeah, it went from fun and times to as soon as I got up, I got drunk or I used and I stayed that way all day. And that mm-hmm. worked for a little bit. It mm-hmm. didn't really, it made me able to
cope with the shame.
Exactly.
And then there came a point where it didn't work anymore.
It didn't. And when, you know, then, and so this 10-year period, 6 months later, I'm busted by the Harris County Sheriff's Department. I'm raided. I'm caught with an apartment full of drugs. I catch 3 felony dope cases.
And you were drinking by this time.
I'm drinking a half gallon of vodka, half gallon of Blue Label Smirnoff.
You're on fire.
Every day.
You're on fire.
And I'm using cocaine mm-hmm. and I'm using a lot of pills. I'm doing, I'm just totally loaded. And so they kicked my door in and I went to prison. So what ended up happening on that arrest for the car accident was I was charged with criminally negligent homicide. I probably had no contest. I was given 5 years probation and 6 months later I was raided by the drug task force, the sheriff's office and busted with like 15 pounds of pot and a couple ounces of cocaine and a sheet of acid. And I just, there was no bond. I was on felony probation already. So I went straight to jail, straight to prison. Mm-hmm. And,
how many years were you in prison?
I did 4 that mm-hmm. time. Mm-hmm. I did 4 of 5. And when I got there, things got really bad because it was just an evil place. And
were you ashamed to be there?
Oh, absolutely.
So I mean, so it just fed the flames of shame, didn't it?
Well, it's just mind blowing when you get in there and you see how human beings are treated inside the penitentiary, and you realize that like you're basically treated like cattle, and you know they feed you and they clothe you, but like they just put you in a pen with a bunch mm-hmm. of other angry, pissed off drug users that don't have any life skills. And, anything goes in there. I mean, that's pretty much the bottom line is anything goes. And, you see a lot of really evil, violent stuff. And you're also just terrified. And you also, there's a survival instinct that kicks in and says, you have to do what it takes to survive here. And I wasn't from the streets. I was a big, strong kid. I mean, I'm 6'5", at the time I'm 6'5", 185 because I'm sucked up from drugs, but I quickly gained maybe 60 pounds. And
so you were really experiencing evil.
On levels that I couldn't have imagined before. Right. I was a college student from a white collar family.
Uh-huh.
I had no experience in this realm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So in other words, if you were going to find a God of your understanding, if you were going to really get some assistance from a power greater than yourself, it was going to come at a terrible price, wasn't it? It was going to come hammered out on the anvils of experience and pain.
I remember praying.
You went through pain, man.
I remember praying. And
in prison?
Oh, yeah.
Get me out of this one. Mm-hmm. I'll do anything. I'll do anything.
But you know what? The drugs were there.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
I was young and tough and just learned to live there. And after about 18 months in the penitentiary, you pretty much become somewhat institutionalized in the sense that it just seems normal. You don't really want to communicate with the outside world anymore because it's too painful and you just deal with what's in front of you.
Yeah.
And hold
that thought. If you're just joining us, my name is Toby C. The name of the show is called The Fourth Dimension. I'm the host. We're here with Christopher M. Like we do every show in the Fourth Dimension, we talk about evil resistance that many of us experience during our earliest attempts at recovery. And right now we're talking with Christopher, who apparently your demon, it sounds to me like, was the demon of shame. And something even deeper than shame, because it sounds to me like, and again, we understand today that only God could and would if he were sought. And you had you just described a very similar experience that I had, where in our most utter desperate moments, despite what was going on around us, we had a moment where we really cried out to God to help us, you know, that we'd do anything. But for some peculiar reason, Christopher, we just, you know, I don't know about you, but I never honored that agreement. You know, for some reason I got distracted by sex, drugs, and rock and roll, or some distraction was out there that kept me from honoring my agreement, despite all the suffering and the misery and the pain that I went through. Was that your experience too?
Yeah, I was observing what was going on around me, and I was like, well, it's not going to get me anywhere to throw up the Christian flag around here. You know what I'm saying? This thing, they're kicking those guys' heads in on the regular. And
did they have AA in prison? 12-step?
They did have not very much. Maybe like once a month you could, and it was so hard to get to and kind of controlled. It was kind of, so any event like that in the penitentiary system was used as a way for the gang members to communicate between pods. So like all the pods would get to go to this meeting. And so it wasn't what I would call a productive AA meeting.
No.
But I would go just to get out of the tank and go, you know, I got involved in gangs as well.
For survival. You lived for 4 years.
Well, you know, I just was bored. I don't know if I ever felt like I needed to do it. I just finally, when they took my parole away, and you know, I got involved in a riot. Mm-hmm. I got backed into a corner. I got my parole taken away from me for getting out of my bed and defending myself. And when they took my parole date, I was like, well, you know what? You got, okay. You're going to keep me for 5 years. You're going to earn that. And I just really went headlong into, I don't really give a shit. You know what I mean? You can't put me in jail again. And I just went nuts.
And ambivalence.
Yeah.
When you ain't got nothing, you ain't got nothing to lose. And that's an attitude for sure. The real tragedy that followed you around, the shameful tragedy was this woman losing her life in this terrible mm-hmm. car accident, mm-hmm. and that maybe your condition had something to do with it. But again, as we've discussed, and I'm sure you've contemplated before you even said so, that it could have happened under any circumstances, but it just happened to be that you were loaded, and you knew it. And there it was an itch that you just kept needing to scratch, wasn't it?
It made me feel irredeemable, if that makes sense. I didn't think that there was any hope in my life from that point on. I'm an extremely loving, caring person. I was brought up in a great family. When I took someone's life, it just destroyed me. And so I just said, all right, if there's no rules, there's no rules. You know, if there's no... I'm not going to heaven, so I'm going to do whatever I want.
How interesting.
Yeah, I gave up on that whole thing.
So this pitiful, incomprehensible shame really led to ambivalence and hopelessness, didn't it, Christopher?
Completely. I was destroyed.
Okay, so and if you ain't got nothing to live for, then you know, party on, Garth.
Yeah, just, you know, right? Just headlong into hedonism and
which again is just opening ourselves up to more negative and evil, and we even described that may have been happening early on as a resistance of this force-fed dogma and doctrine of ecumenical force feeding. So
possibly,
I get it.
Yeah, you know, look at kind of, so you know when I ended up going to prison twice, 10 years of my life, in and out of the penitentiary, on the streets, dealing drugs, completely addicted to opiates and alcohol, cocaine, went back to prison for the second time. Now, I'd been getting forced into AA meetings at this point by my parole officer, but I was making no progress. I got busted again, 2006. I went back to the penitentiary on a morphine cocaine charge. I did a year, and then I started going, I can't do this anymore.
All right. Perfect time for a break. We're going to be right back with Christopher M. I'm Toby C. I'm the host. The name of the show is called The Fourth Dimension. The theme of this show is we talk about evil resistance, the devil, negative paranormal energy, whatever you want to call it, man, bad luck. But we get it on here at the Fourth Dimension with Toby C, and we're really mashing it out with Christopher. We're going to be right back after this break for our final segment of Hour 1 on the Fourth Dimension with Toby C with Christopher M. Be right back.
Our message, then please visit us at itmtoby.com.
Are you feeling a little uncomfortable? Then you're right where you belong, in the fourth dimension with Toby C.
Okay, mashing it out with Christopher M. Toby C. here. The name of the show is called The Fourth Dimension. We're talking about evil resistance that many of us sufferers experience in early recovery, although we don't know it at the time because we're in the moment, you know. But calmly and objectively looking back, like we have for the past hour with Christopher, is, maybe God did for us what we couldn't do for ourselves, but maybe there was the presence of something evil and we just weren't aware of it. Maybe we were in denial of it. I don't know. But anyway, give us a takeaway here. Kind of tie it all together. What was going on? You mentioned that you did a little bit more time in prison, that you weren't quite finished bouncing along the bottom there, Christopher. But finally something happened for you. Finally, describe that finally something happened for you to us and to the listener.
When I did another stint from 2006 to 2007. I got out. I was completely convinced that I was doomed at that point. And the thing that started happening to me that really scared me was, A, when I went to prison the first time, I thought I'll never come back here. When I went back the second time, I knew everyone, you know, and I got out and everyone I knew started dying. They started overdosing. They started catching long sentences. And I started to realize I was going to catch a bullet or I was going to overdose. And, I was getting really scared. My life had turned into a complete hellscape. And I was, you know, $200-$300 a day drug habit.
And were your parents talking to you?
No, I had completely left my, you know, I just completely left and moved to the other side of town. My whole life was dealing drugs and providing for my habit. And so I was living in a dope house, growing pot. And it was just a nightmare. And
it was a dream come true that turned into a nightmare, wasn't it?
Yeah, I had a parole officer, and one day I just leveled with her, and I said, you know, I couldn't take a clean test. And she said, Jay, I'm gonna send you back to prison. Oh, I'm gonna send you back to prison, I don't know, you know. I said, I don't know. Her name was Mrs. Ricks. I said, I don't know what to tell you. You can tell me that you're gonna send me to prison, and I'll still use. And I don't know how to stop. And she started sending me to Alcoholics Anonymous. She said, you take this sheet. She gave me this big, long sheet. She said, go to AA, and you get a signature every time you go to the meeting.
Oh, interesting. You're telling her I'm possessed, and there's nothing you can do about it. And she said, maybe you are possessed, but we can do something about that.
She said, you need to go to AA. That's all I can think to tell you to do. And I'm going to test you on this date. And so she's even trying to like tell me, I'm going to test you on this date, you know.
How interesting though, Chris. You know, you may have, whether you know it or not, looking back, you may have been telling her in your indignant language that I'm going to use no matter what. That was really a metaphor of saying I'm possessed by the devil and there ain't nothing you can do about it, baby. You can try all day long, man, but he's here and he's here to stay. And I'll tell you, one of the nicest things, one of the most interesting things I've read lately is that at the end of the day, there is no real solution for deep core evil except intercessory prayer to really open ourselves up to God. And that's kind of what we do in 12-step recovery, trust God and clean house and open ourselves up. But anyway, continue.
So I started going to these meetings. And I ran into this dude in a 10 p.m. candlelight meeting, and he was talking about being on the streets and shooting up in gas station bathrooms. And this is a junkie for sure. He'd been to prison. But the thing that blew my mind was he was wearing a suit, He had a nice car, he owned a restaurant, and I knew that he had been where I was, and I knew that he was not there anymore. And I still didn't believe in recovery. I just wanted to know what the hell this guy knew. You know what I'm saying?
The mustard seed of faith, man. You knew at that moment, you know, if this guy can go from this to that, maybe, just maybe, I can do it too. Despite, you know, all the evidence otherwise. What do you think?
I was such a pessimist. I didn't really think it was possible. I just wanted to know what this guy knew, you know, and I asked him to sponsor me.
And you were attracted to something about him, weren't you?
Yeah, he was happy. He had a lot of people around him. And
it wasn't evil, wasn't it? It wasn't evil. It was good.
No, there was something about him that I was that really piqued my curiosity. And so I asked, you know, what do I do? And he gave me this book.
How interesting. So that was your first turning point in recovery. You were attracted to something good. You were attracted to a message. Let me ask you this, Christopher. Were you denied that opportunity way back in the very beginning to have gone to a meeting and to have listened to a good message and to have been attracted to something good? Or was it just not your time?
I was absolutely closed off to it.
Completely.
And
the door was shut. There was not one mustard seed or grain of hope, was there?
It didn't seem like
And there wasn't any purpose.
No, I didn't.
It didn't even seem
like an option. Mm-hmm. It didn't seem like an option. And this guy, and I could barely think. I mean, I knew I was going to prison again, and that would be it. And he said, I said, what do I do? What do I do? Like, what do I do tonight when you leave? You know? And he said, you take this book and you go home and you pray your ass off and you believe that this works. That's all I want you to do is just believe that this works. And I go, I don't believe that this is going to work. And he said, do you believe that I believe this works? And I said, yeah.
Love it.
And he goes, that's good enough.
That was the moment.
Yeah. And he sponsored me and took me through the steps over the next 40 days, I think.
So you know, I often describe recovery as kind of like a trap door, and we all resist this trap door. But that moment, he said, "Do you believe that I believe that you know
that, yeah,
this thing, that this thing will work?" That was the moment that you allowed yourself to slip through the trap door and move from denial into acceptance that maybe, just maybe, this thing's going to work for you and your life is going to change for the better. What do you think?
I think there was probably something in me that felt like that. I think I remember the biggest thought I remember having was, I'm going to do all this stuff and I'm going to show you that it's not going to work. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, you know, why not? Why not just do this so that they know I'm hopeless? And I started doing it. And when I got to the inventory and I came clean about that accident and the fact that I was loaded, no one knew. And that I was, you know, that I'd killed someone loaded and I'd never told a human being about it in my entire life. I got undeniable relief. And this man talked to me about what we spoke about earlier. It was, what if, Jay, this was just an accident?
You overcame shame at that moment, man. You had some tools and a map how to get out of shame finally. How nice. Christopher J. Hey, listen, we're going to be back for hour two here, and we're going to mash it out. This was a good hour, though. I really appreciate you taking us on this magical mystery tour back to your earliest memories of recovery. Thank you so much for hour one, and come back for hour two soon.
Will do.
All right. I'm Toby C. Name of the show is called The Fourth Dimension. We're wrapping it up with Christopher M. Be right back.
If you enjoy our message, then please visit us at itmtoby.com.
Welcome to The Fourth Dimension with Toby C., where participants dare to disclose bizarre experiences that occur in early recovery. The battle between good and evil, of God and of the occult. The psychic challenges we all encounter when trying to do the right thing. Now, here's Toby.
Hey, it's me, it's Toby, I'm back. Oh yeah, hour two with Christopher M. better believe it. You have entered the fourth dimension with Toby C. Hey, check this out. You unlock the door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension, a dimension of sound, a dimension of sight, a dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You just crossed over into the fourth dimension. Actually, it's from the Twilight Zone. Do you recognize that? Yeah. How you doing? Welcome back. I'm Toby C. The name of the show is The Fourth Dimension. It's a concept show. And the concept is you're not going to hear a lot about God during the next hour when we talk about recovery from drugs and alcohol and anything that you might be suffering from or somebody you love might be suffering from. Instead, this hour, we're going to be talking about, as we do every show in The Fourth Dimension, the antithesis of God. We're going to be talking about the devil. We're going to be talking about Satan. We're going to be talking about the dark angel, negative paranormal experiences, whatever you want to call it. But what we're trying to do is capture what happens in early recovery when somebody decides, when we decide, when I decide to get better, something external happened. Although at the time it was happening, I was probably too sick to understand it. And now what we're doing in every show and what we're going to continue doing here with Christopher M. is we're going back in time to his earliest memories, his earliest experiences in recovery he's sharing with us, and trying to pinpoint evil, negative, external experiences that really discouraged us and kept us from getting better. So there it is. You know, Christopher M., welcome back, man, for hour number two.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Last hour was a pretty hairy hour. We covered a lot of territory, some trauma, some life-changing experiences. You know, I think we finished it off with your fifth step. You finally, when all the dust settled, you were finally able to overcome this shame cycle, and you were finally able to get honest with another person, and you got some relief, and you did your fifth step, and all of a sudden recovery started to work for you, didn't it?
It did. It was an undeniable experience. I was carrying. So the first thing that happened to me was that I was absolutely blown away that there was so much power in telling someone the whole truth. And it was overwhelming. I felt undeniable relief after my fifth step. And like I had never had before. Like, I mean, I was suffering from PTSD. I was seeing this accident over and over. I was reliving like these terrible things in my life, and when I did that, and I told Nick the whole truth about the situation,
your sponsor, yeah,
my sponsor, yeah. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize it right away, but what I never had any more of these episodes where I kept reliving the accident, and. I felt so light. I mean, you know, you don't realize how heavy this stuff is until it goes away, because it's, you know, it's sort of like the frog in the pot of water analogy, where he stays in there. If you start him off on lukewarm and you warm it up, he just stays in there until he boils. Mm-hmm. And I've become very accustomed to just living with it. And
you didn't think really anything could really relieve your suffering. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden you found a man who you trusted that was in a program, and you tapped into a power, an incredible power, didn't you? Gave you such relief.
Absolutely. And I became very suspicious that AA was working. Mm-hmm. And it was really...
You tapped into a power, but you weren't sure what this power was all about.
I wasn't. I didn't know what it was. I didn't understand it, but I felt it. And
you believed it.
I believed that I was getting, I knew that I was getting relief. And I had never had any, so it was just life-changing. So I went from this person that literally did the steps because my real thought was, I'm going to do all this stuff exactly the way they tell me to do it. And then I'm going to get up at the end of the year and say, it didn't work. Now what? You know, like, I told you. And that started to fall apart immediately when I did my fifth step. And I carried on and kept doing work with Nick religiously. And things just got undeniably better. But I still didn't have any discernment between who was well and who was sick.
How interesting. Let me just interject something here, Chris. Christopher, you believed in a power. You experienced a power from this man, from your sponsor, from this fellowship that he was in. You didn't. You experienced it. You believed it. You felt it. But did you at that moment realize that this was the power of God? Or was this just the power of this fellowship and this man and this mysterious fellowship that he was part of?
Well, I think the first thing that came with it was I became very suspicious that this God thing could be real. And I also made the assumption that, oh, everybody at AA is doing this and having this experience, and therefore they are all God loving, on the same path as me, can all be trusted. And many of the people I met along the way to this day, I can still trust, but I also ran into a lot of characters and, you know, I started to be able to go to work. I started working for a business, and we started doing, work for some of the other people in my club, and immediately started running into people that were hiring me and not paying me at the AA club, you know.
There you go.
And it was very, very discouraging. I mean, to go to a meeting and listen to somebody talk about spirituality and you're staring at them across the table and they owe you $350.
how interesting. And this is a group that you trusted.
Yeah,
now, very much. If you're out in the real world and somebody stitches some for some work, that's one thing. But it hurts extra deep when it comes from somebody you trust. And the point I'm trying to make here, Christopher, is, remember, it's trust God, clean house, help others. That's kind of our mantra in the 12-step program. Trust God, clean house, help others. Did you trust God, or were you trusting another man and trusting, you know, people within the fellowship? Were you putting, in other words, the answer is pretty evident. You were really trusting the personalities and the fallible members of this fellowship.
Yeah.
And you didn't know it at the time.
It hadn't occurred to me that there's people hanging out in AA that aren't doing the work, and they're just the same people that they were when they showed up.
They don't get better, do they? Yeah. Some people just kind of, they stall out. They're dry. They're kind of doing the deal, yeah. Hey, by the way, if you're just joining us for this long segment, my name is Toby C. Name of the show is called The Fourth Dimension. We're here with Christopher M. We're talking about evil resistance that many people encounter during our earliest experiences in recovery. Evil in the sense that it's external. It's something, it's him or her or it or the experience, but it's something very discouraging that makes us question whether or not we're really on the right track. And you certainly had that experience there, Christopher. Early on, you were trusting God by trusting the fellowship and trusting the members within the fellowship, and you got burned, didn't you?
Yeah, I think, and then that's inevitable in life. So, you know, and the good far outweighed the bad. But
it's fine, but it's not supposed to happen in AA.
I was very angry about it.
Did you feel like you were surrounded by a bunch of freaking hypocrites all of a sudden?
That's how I started to feel, you know, after several months. I had three or four people in the room that had burned me or something.
That wasn't an inside job. That affected your bottom line, didn't it?
It made me, because I was going to AA because I felt safe there. I was hiding in AA from the world, and I was learning things that were making me feel better. So it was my refuge. And so when that started to happen, I started to be suspicious that, you know, like something's not right here.
They violated the sanctity of AA. It was supposed to be a sanctified, holy place where people got better, not where people took advantage and hurt one another.
Well, yeah. And so it was funny the way that worked itself out was this guy, he's a speaker, and he went around all over the country talking. And he came to talk at our club, and it was a local club. It was a few miles away. And his whole group came with him, and they came in. And I knew some of them, but they all showed up together. They were all extremely, just very happy. They were very kind, and they got along. You know, they seemed like they were getting along great. And I just thought, wow, these guys are kind of making my home group look like a bunch of grumps. And so they invited me to come over, and I said, all right. And I did. I went and checked it out, and I met a new sponsor over there.
So Christopher changed home groups. Now, there's a takeaway you know, listeners, if you're out there and you have a loved one who's stuck and they're really pissed off with their group therapy, their home group, and I don't care if you're an AA or any recovery program, but there's something, I promise you, and it's something external that wants to push Christopher and push Toby and push you away from a loving group of unified people trying to get better. There's the deal. And it happens all the time. And the takeaway that so many of us have is, man, I really trusted these people and they turned out to be a bunch of hypocrites, you know, and they violated the sanctity of my recovery. And now where do I go? So fortunately, you didn't have to answer that. Now where do I go? You had another home group to jump to, didn't you?
Yeah, I slowly migrated over to this other club, and it wasn't everybody over there. My sponsor was great; I loved him, but I was so I took these issues to some people that I met over there that I found to be on track, and I felt like they were doing what they were supposed to do, and I got involved with a new sponsor, and it was kind of funny because then he's like, you don't lie, you're really upset about this money. And I'm like, yeah, those people are in AA, they're supposed to pay me, man. And he's like, okay, well, let's take a look at your debts. And I was like, huh? The reason I was attracted to this guy was that I owed a lot of money. You know, I owed $75,000 or $80,000 from bad loan. It turns out when you borrow money and don't pay it back, that's stealing too. And just being a criminal, I owed a bunch of money, and I told this guy about this, and he was like, well, you know, when I got sober 20 years ago, I owed $1 million to the IRS, and they were taking everything I had, and today I'm free and clear. He's sober for about 20 years. And his wife was the financial administrator of the family, and she sat down, and she taught me how to manage money, and we got really hardcore into paying these amends. And I started to pay back my debts, and again in the ninth step I was blown away because I started getting more relief, and at that point I was connected with the dots were put together, and I was like, this is about God, and the closer I get with my fellow human being, and these people that I owe, the better I feel and the more connection I feel with God. And so over a period of like 2 years, I paid off all my debts.
What Christopher's talking about are the promises, the miracle of recovery. Good things happen. But I'll tell you, we're not going to let Christopher run with all the beautiful godlike things that happen in recovery. We're going to back up and go back to evil experiences that kept us from getting better. But we're moving right along. Stand by. We're going to be right back. My name is Toby C. The name of the show is called The Fourth Dimension. We're going to be right back with Christopher M. talking about evil resistance in early recovery.
If you enjoy our message, then please visit us at itmtoby.com.
The imagination to take us places we might be afraid to go. You are entering the fourth dimension with Toby C. There is no such thing as coincidences. Here's Toby.
You know, the point of this program is to talk about evil, to talk about evil resistance that many of us experience in early recovery. The reason why we talk about the devil is that if the figure of the devil is missing, then one also loses sight of the figure of God itself. In this program, the 12-step program, like many programs in recovery, they talk about overcoming self-consciousness by acquiring God consciousness, by getting out of self, by moving away from self-centeredness and self-consciousness and moving towards something called God consciousness. So that's all we're trying to do. We're trying to make God real by talking about real evil. And evil disguises itself in so many different forms, especially in early recovery. And one of the areas that we're exploring with Christopher here is the fellowship, you know, the evil that exists within the fellowship itself, you know. Recovery is a miraculous process. The 12-step program really worked well for me, and as it does for many people. But it's not a smooth journey. It's not a smooth journey, man. There's a lot of bumps in the road, and those bumps in the road are men and women, okay? Friendships and relationships, sexual, non-sexual, intimate, non-intimate, but there they are, man. Let's get into a couple more bumps in the road there, Christopher, on unhealthy relationships and recovery. How about that?
Well, that's pretty easy. I mean, they happen. I was kind of chuckling because as you were saying that, I was thinking, I'm at my new club. I'm making progress. My life is getting better. I've been sober for about 2 years. And I, because of this debt, I was so driven to pay this debt. I took this job from another fellow that was over at the other club. And what I found was that it offered me the money that I wanted, that I needed to pay this. It was a traveling job. And that's how I ended up out here, actually, in California. But I went and I worked for this guy for a couple of years. But I realized after working for him for a couple of years, this guy was doing a lot of really wacko stuff. And for instance, after I worked for almost a year and I'd been paid maybe $100,000, I got my tax paperwork back and it said I'd been paid 24. And I was like, well, you know, at first I thought this is great. And I went and told my sponsor and he's like, no, this isn't great because you're being fraudulent with the IRS and you can't buy anything because nobody thinks you have any money, you know? And he's like, we don't do this. And I'm like, yeah, but he's in AA. And it's like, yeah, well, you know, so, you know, I don't want to go too far into detail, but again, I was disappointed.
So there it is. You know, the reoccurring theme that Christopher is talking about is unrealistic expectations that so many of us have when we get into recovery, yeah. Especially when it comes to the people that we're depending on to help us get better. And remember, gang, people do not help us get better. It's God, as he expresses himself through other people, is what gets us better ultimately. But in early recovery, so many of us don't understand this God connection, you know? We can understand that you got better, and I believe you got better, and I believe you can get me better. So there's the relationship, you know? And give us another example with the time remaining in this short segment before the bottom of the hour of another disappointing relationship, friendship, experience you had with a sponsor or somebody you respected in recovery that made you second guess whether or not you're in the right group. Do you remember that?
I think one of the really, really hard things for me was my original sponsor ended up relapsing and he had a cancer and he started taking the pain meds and he got completely junked out. And that was really hard for me because I felt like my life, I felt indebted to this man, you know, and I was off traveling and this guy was calling me, this guy who had saved my life and was like my hero. Like he was my hero. He'd been sober for 17 years and he was strung out on, you know, fentanyl and heavy stuff. And I just, you know,
that was pretty confusing, wasn't it?
It was very confusing. It was very painful because I felt responsible. Like I wanted to do something for him, but you know, you can't. And, you know, I would send people after him and he would refuse the help. And it was just a very confusing thing. And I guess it just led me back to the people are fallible thing, you know?
Yeah. But maybe at that moment, Christopher, you were thinking, gee, is this a preview of coming attractions? Is this what I have to look forward to? Absolutely. Is this really what a sober life has in store for me? And it was very discouraging, wasn't it?
It was.
You were thinking maybe, you know, maybe, maybe I quit too early. Maybe I got out of the game a little too early here. If this is really what I have to look forward to, right? So,
I got through it. I remained sober, but, it was heavy on my heart all the time. The amazing thing was that I always found the good to offset the evil, but I always put myself in a position and I think
to get a heavy heart
greed, yeah. I think because I just looked at things dollars and cents.
We're going to be right back with Christopher M. My name's Toby C. The name of the show is called The Fourth Dimension, talking about evil resistance that many of us encounter during our earliest experiences in recovery when we try to get better. We're going to be right back with Christopher M. Stand by.
Our message, then please visit us at itmtoby.com.
Making sense out of nonsense, making you as curious and uncomfortable as possible with the truth. You've landed in the fourth dimension with Toby C.
Well, I'll tell you, there's no question about it. I'm going to let Christopher run with most of this segment, but some of the most evil, negative, discouraging experiences that we can have in recovery is relationships with other people in recovery. That includes our sponsor, that includes our peers, that includes elder statesmen that we look up to, that includes members of the opposite sex. Just the whole cornucopia of society is embodied within the group, the kinship of common suffering. It's there. It's just as sick as out there, but it's really sick inside there. Christopher, take us on a little tour of your relationship experiences, your discouraging, evil, if you will, disappointing relationships in early recovery.
That's pretty easy. That's probably the second thing, the other big thing that plagued me was that I could not leave the girls alone. And in my life, in my prime, I spent most of my prime in prison, my 20s. And AA, it's a weird thing, but AA is the only place in the world where, like, if you go to prison, you're like more
you're
popular
a rock star.
Because of it. Yeah, you're more popular. They love it. The rock girls star. Love it for some reason. And
bad boy.
That's not the case anywhere else, really. I mean, to be honest with you. And I continually got involved with girls from the club that were newly sober. And, the trouble that comes with that is just tremendous. And I would pick out a girl based on the way she looks and get involved with her sexually. And then slowly over a short period, realize that I don't really like this girl. You know what I mean? Like, I just don't, there's nothing about her I like other than her appearance. And so that was...
Hey, you know, life can be a lonely experience. Recovery can be a lonely experience. We want to be close to somebody. We need companionship. We need friends. We need fellowship. I get it. But still, you didn't pick one. You didn't pick a healthy one.
Ever.
And don't give yourself so much credit that you had a bad picker, that you're incapable of picking a healthy one. The devil showed up in a short mini skirt and hot legs and a smoking hot body. And never mind, man, you know, it's instincts on rampage.
Well, my problem is that when that girl walks in, I see it as a blessing. And it's not, it's the opposite.
Well,
and, but you know, I was guided through. I mean, I had some of the most crazy experiences and the other thing that would do is that would totally divert my attention from my recovery. Completely divert. So I would not only am I sick, I would get sicker as soon as I got into one of these relationships, and things would go bad quickly, you know?
Beautiful. You know, it's almost biblical. It says that the reason why we want to be alert and sober of mind is the devil prowls around like a lion looking for a soul or a vulnerable spirit to devour. And when we're distracted, we're not on our toes and alert, are we? And there's nothing more distracting than him or her when they walk in the door and our heart starts to pound and our groin gets hot. You know?
And I definitely had that. Looking back, it's easy to look back and see, like, you have this instinct to, like, procreate, you know, and it was definitely a haywire. And And I'm just, as an example of the craziest one was I had a girlfriend, I'd met her. She was way younger than me. She was sober for a couple of years. And I think within a 24-hour period, I realized that she had slept with my sponsee, who was like 18, and my sponsor, who was 63. and I just like was blown away, you know.
She was a giver.
Yeah, she was a lover. And, God bless her soul. I hope she's well. But
yeah, but still, it was another disappointing.
It was a painful experience.
It was another disappointing experience.
It was a painful experience.
Christopher, you trusted somebody. You trusted another person in recovery, and they disappointed you. Not only did you trust this person, but they distracted you. They really distracted you. And quite often, you know, evil, the antithesis of God, a loving God wants us to get better, man. And there's something that doesn't want us to get better, and it wants to throw all kinds of interference in the way. And there it was. You know, what a clear example of interference. It walked in the room. You didn't order it.
So
it was right there.
I would do it over and over too. And I never had any long-term relationships. They would always last a few months. And then I would go on this, crusade to stay out of relationships and focus on my recovery and spend my time like with men in AA and which would lead me to the assumption that after I'd done this for a year or something and gotten over all this discomfort, that I was somehow changed and different, you know, and I'd be better and I'd get into another relationship that was exactly like the last one. And it would happen over and over. And in those periods, in those growth periods between relationships, I did a lot of work and I got a lot of relief. But I can tell you that the desire or the fall or the whatever it was in me that kept leading me into these things, it didn't go away. You know what I mean? Like it's still a part of me today. And,
let me ask you this, Christopher, did you experience, in early recovery boredom?
Oh yeah.
All right. And did dating and relationships and the opposite sex kind of, alleviate some of that boredom?
It
made it more interesting, you know, or so you thought. I mean, there's different ways to make recovery interesting. Okay.
I made it interesting.
By the way, there's a lot of different ways to make life interesting, isn't there? Yeah. And there's good ways and there's not so good ways. And our default, unfortunately, even in early recovery, is to pick maybe the not so good ways to keep things interesting. And what do you think? Was that part of the draw? Just
absolutely
trying to keep it interesting, trying to keep it fun.
Just being irresponsible. I mean, growing up, I mean, I was a 35-year-old man and like with the emotional maturity of about a 19-year-old.
Yeah.
And which I figured out, like, if I'm going to find a relationship that suits me, no one's attracted to that.
You know, by the way, Christopher, we talked about last hour that part of your experience in early recovery and the trauma that you experienced in early recovery and the shame cycle that you were caught up in early recovery robbed you of a decade of your precious life. Okay. Yeah. And let me ask you this. Did you have a sense like I got a little catch up to do here?
Absolutely.
Well, there it is. Okay.
Absolutely. That was all in play. You know, I'd lost my 20s to the prison system and the streets. And I just had this an uncontrollable desire to succeed. And that picture in my head looked like make a bunch of money, buy a house, and have a family. Although I didn't want the responsibility and didn't know how to be in a long-term relationship, for sure.
Yeah.
And so I didn't even realize some of those forces were working. I'll tell you, when I did realize this is when I had my child 2 years ago. I just realized, like, this is what I'm supposed to do. Yeah. This is probably what I was supposed to do. Yeah.
Interesting. Now, but you just said it just now, Christopher. I didn't realize that those forces were working. Uh-uh. Describe those forces. It was something evil. It was something that didn't have your best interest in mind. It was something that wanted to keep you down.
Yeah, it was just kind of like the whole I want to be hip, slip, and cool and have a nice truck and a good-looking woman on my arm. And I want to do that forever.
Thank you. They're called shallow, self-serving, limited objectives. We talk about that, right, in the big book.
It was running my life.
And how many of us pursue shallow, self-serving, limited objectives? The nice truck, the wife, the kids, the nice house. Okay, we get it. But you know something? Something's missing from that menu, wasn't it? Something was missing from that menu, wasn't it? It was a solid relationship with a power greater than yourself, wasn't it?
You come to terms with these things. I don't know. I'm pretty hard headed, but I realized I wasn't finding any fulfillment in the life I was living, but I didn't know how to stop doing it at all. Yeah. So fast forward, I ended up in California. And I loved it out here because there's so much recovery here. And I was somewhat young still. My life got so much better. I mean, so much better. But I still brought these things with me everywhere I went. You just slowly start to realize, like, there's just more to figure out here. There's something that I don't understand here. And I was always guided to the people that could get me there. But my initial reaction to people that gave me good guidance and directed me towards where I probably really should be. It was like, no, dude, I'm not doing that. You know, like I'm very resistant. I am extremely defiant and it almost, I see, it's scary because I see it in my child now. You know, I always assumed that I was that way because of my experience with drugs and alcohol and all the things bad mm-hmm. that had happened to me.
It's hereditary.
What I realized is I have a daughter now that has a perfect life that's with her mom and dad all the time. And she is so defiant. There she is. She is so me. And I'm like, oh, my God, I was like that when I was born.
Yeah. And this resistance, this defiance is about not wanting to surrender, not wanting to take it easy, not wanting to go with the flow, just trying to control the show, control the outcome,
manipulate
the whole scenery until we can get it. By the way, I want to finish up our last segment, Christopher, about your experience in sponsorship and how you got into sponsorship, some of the bumps in the road you experienced in sponsorship, some of the things you learned from some of the sponsors that you had that you decided that you didn't want to repeat with people that you were working with. So we're going to do that, though, because trust God, clean house, and help others. Were you able to jump into sponsorship and helping others pretty early on?
I did. That was my saving grace. I was very involved in that. From the early get-go, the man that saved my life, who I still have a relationship with today, sober again, but he immediately started to tell me, he immediately, when I got a vehicle and started taking myself to meetings, he immediately directed me to this halfway house where these guys that were getting out of prison and off the streets, he'd say, you go over there before the meeting and you get one of those guys and you take him to the meeting. And I'd say, I don't know what to say to him. And he's like, don't say anything to him. Just take him to the meeting, and I started to do that. And I started to realize it made me feel better.
And looking back, maybe what was making you feel better was the fact that you were not only serving another suffering man, but unbeknownst to you, you were serving God at that moment.
Yeah,
and it was
sure.
God. It was God who was making you feel better. How interesting. My name is Toby C. We're talking about evil resistance that many of us encounter in early recovery. We're here with Christopher M. We're going to wrap up our last segment talking about the fourth dimension, a higher planular level of thinking, where we can think outside the limitations of a three-dimensional world. We're going to be right back. Christopher M., The Fourth Dimension with Toby C.
If you enjoy our message, then please visit us at itmtoby.com.
Are you feeling a little uncomfortable? Then you're right where you belong. in the fourth dimension with Toby C.
Yeah, everybody feels uncomfortable talking about the devil or Satan, but nobody feels uncomfortable talking about God. But I'm telling you, man, be aware of the existence and the presence of evil. And I swear it'll give you a good, overwhelming reason to get close to a God of your understanding. We're wrapping up this hour with Christopher M. And Christopher is going to talk to us about how he overcame evil resistance by starting to pay attention to other suffering souls and his experience in doing that. Take it away, Chris.
Well, I think, you know, we were talking about sponsorship, and I started to do that early on in my first year. And the experiences were undeniable. They gave me revelations that I could have never come to on my own. And a lot of times they showed me it's like I was able to get outside of myself and watch my behavior from a different point of from outside. And so for instance, this one story I'm thinking of in particular, I had stayed up all night. We had pulled this fella out of a dope hotel. And we were taking him to treatment, and we spent all night, probably 3 a.m. driving this guy around. No one would take him because he was so loaded. And so the sober living house guy said, we're going to take him home and put him back in the sober living. And in the morning at 9 a.m., I found this place that was going to take him the next morning at 9. So I got up after, sleeping maybe 3 or 4 hours. And I drove over to his house, and this place was way down a dirt road, and there was a field so they could see you coming. And I drove down this road to go get this guy because I was going to save him. You know what I mean? I was going to help this fella. He's going to get him sober. And when he saw me coming down the road, he ran into the bathroom and locked himself in. So I went in and I was like, where is such and such? And they're like, he's in the bathroom. And I went to the door and I started banging on the door. And I was like, hey, get out of here. We're going to rehab. And he's like, no, I'm not going. And I was furious because I was tired and I made all this effort. And this dude, he wasn't having it. And after several minutes of beating on the door and talking to this guy through the door, I all of a sudden realized that I was standing in the exact position my father had been standing for years.
Took you right back, didn't it?
I was overwhelmed with this feeling of understanding of the love.
Role reversal,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, the
role
love
reversal.
My dad had for me. Yeah. And I'd never seen it like that.
Wow.
And I just thought, oh my God, my family, they were such good people. They always tried to help me and I always refused their help and ran away.
So at that moment, Christopher, you were really recognizing the presence of evil, weren't you?
Oh, this stuff
This is it. And you knew at that moment, I don't have any control over this.
Mm-mm.
Just like my old man had no control over me. It's futile, exactly.
This guy was not getting help. But I tell you what, I walked away from that situation. I went to work that day. I worked the whole day long. And because of what had happened and that experience, that thought, that realization of how much my dad loved me and mm-hmm. what he had been through to get me to where I was today, mm-hmm. it was just like the greatest day ever. Mm-hmm. And that guy, he never got sober. He's still on the streets today. But it changed my life forever. It changed my life forever. And
you got into work pretty early on in recovery, didn't you? You had a sponsor who got you right into working with others. And here's the deal, gang. I'm telling you, you don't have to complete the 12 steps and ring the bell in order to start paying attention to another suffering soul. In the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, in chapter 7, working with others, towards the end of that chapter, it says even the newest of newcomers, if they really, pay attention, can find somebody even blinder and in more pain than they are. And then recovery starts, And then recovery really starts. And do you ever have any experiences working with newcomers where it was nothing short of an exorcism? Where you actually saw the demon pack his shit up and hit the road, say, I'm out of here. I can't handle this anymore. Do you ever have any of those experiences?
I did. And they're it's a numbers game, because I'm telling you that 1 out of 1,000 does it. And when you see it happen, it's mind blowing. And I'm telling you, today, it's been 14, 15 years since I got involved in this stuff. My best friends that I have, every single one of them is a guy that I sponsored and has stayed sober, and I've seen his life get better. And I've just been like, holy crap, this is and they may have moved on to other sponsors, or whatever, but I have this, I had a view of the whole thing. And I think, beautiful. I hate these guys when I meet them. You know what I mean? Like, God, I can't stand this guy.
Answer this question here, Christopher. Why couldn't you experience the joy of the miracle of recovery early on? There it is. So what you're describing is the joy and the miracle of recovery. It's a one in a thousand deal. It's a numbers game. But boy, when you get it, it is so overwhelming. And I guess the answer, it's really a rhetorical question. The answer why so many of us don't get to experience that joy is there's something out there that wants to keep us from that joy, keep us in utter bewilderment and confusion and anger and resentment. Don't you agree?
It's pure evil. And alcoholism and addiction is pure evil. And I use the strong word I said I hate, but what I mean when I say that, like when I start sponsoring somebody and I see what they're doing and they refuse to take work, or take direction, I get so mad because I'm staring at myself. And mm-hmm. So, I love these guys and I give them everything. And it's so disheartening to see them refuse to.
They just won't open that door.
Yeah.
They just won't let you in, man.
But the funny thing is the guys that get better, they don't fight you. They don't fight you. They just blindly do what you ask them to do. Mm-hmm. And, but I tell you what, I'll hold on to the ones that are fighting. Mm-hmm. And spend tremendous energy and have a lot of anguish over it and realize that, and like we talked, it's futile. They're not ready. And,
They're not ready. But again, don't forget, Christopher, it's on God's time. It's not on our time.
Right.
God decides when people are going to get better. So,
right. I have a control issue. I have a major control issue.
All right. So the takeaway from this hour here, Christopher, and thank you so much for spending, the past 2 hours with us, but certainly this hour, the takeaway for the listener, if you're stuck and you want to overcome evil resistance to whatever you're experiencing, is the takeaway message here is to stay with the group. And if your home group's driving you batshit crazy, go find another home group, but don't pull away from the fellowship. And the sooner you, and I'm talking to you, fit yourself to be of maximum service to God and those about you, that means the sooner you prepare yourself for sponsorship, the sooner your life is going to straighten out. And by the way, you may be more ready for sponsorship than you think you are.
That's the
right?
Truth.
Isn't That's that true? The truth. You can always pay attention to somebody, man. So anyway, hang in there, gang. I appreciate you spending the past couple of hours with me and Christopher M. Christopher, thank you so much for joining us on the Fourth Dimension, and appreciate your wisdom.
Thanks for having me, Toby.
All right. Take care. God bless. And I keep trudging the road of happy destiny. Until then, I'm Toby C. with the Fourth Dimension, and God bless.
Message, then please visit us at itmtoby.com.